Hello to all my friends and all of my issues. It's a me, Mario. Woohoo! Mamma mia! You guys, you're number one. Woohoo!
Are you number one? Ho ho!
Wait a second, bro. Here we go. Woohoo!
Hello, Internet, and welcome to another episode of All of My Issues. In this episode, episode 16, we got the opportunity to sit down and talk with comic book legend Ron Frenz. He's worked on every major comic book character you can think of. He's worked on Spider-Man, Superman. He worked on Thor for 7 years. He helped create the New Warriors. He co-created Spider-Girl. The list goes on. He's been in every major comic book you can think of, pretty much. But before we get into the chat that we had with him, let's talk about Geek Fuel. If you're anything like us, and let's face it, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are, you enjoy geeky things, and one of the best ways to get your monthly geek on is to subscribe to Geek Fuel. Geek Fuel will send you a monthly box filled with comic book, gaming, sci-fi, and pop culture related material. Do you like Marvel? Do you like DC? Chances are you're going to get something from both of those companies at one point or another once you subscribe. So right now, if you go to our website, allofmyissues.com, and click the Geek Fuel link, you can save $3 off of your Geek Fuel subscription. You can use those $3 to purchase the new project that Ron Frenz is working on with Darren Henry from Sit Comics called The Blue Baron. You can purchase it now off of Comixology. All right, let's get started. I did want to just say that, you know, it's a pleasure having you on the podcast. First off, I wanted to get that out of the way. So we're happy.
It's my pleasure. I enjoy doing these things. I'm looking forward to seeing what you're curious about and all that kind of jazz. So, I mean, it's my pleasure. It really is.
Awesome. Because I would go as far as to say, I don't want to just speak. I guess I'm speaking for myself as saying that I'm a pretty big fan of your work.
He's not just speaking for himself. So, yeah.
Well, and you know, you sound like Chris Pratt.
Oh, really? Yes. I think that's probably a compliment, right?
That's a pretty good compliment.
And I look just like him, so it's...
It's a compliment. Because I'm fascinated with voices. And there was a guy, I don't know if you've ever met him, I can't think of his name because I suck. But the young guy that does Comic Shenanigans.
Oh, okay.
And he sounds like a Canadian Paul Rudd.
Get out of here.
Between you guys, you know, we could start doing Marvel movies on the radio.
Yeah, right, here we go. That's all we need.
Right? All right, guys.
I love it. Well, I guess, you know, it seems like maybe one of the things we'll just kind of start off with is we did look a little bit into your background, not to be creepy or anything, but we did look a little bit into your background. Okay. And we saw it seemed like you started in the industry rather young. It seemed to us 24, right? Is that right?
Yeah, actually, it would have been more like 23, but yeah, exactly. That's right. Good looking. Yeah, my first gig was I got the call. See, I went to art. I went to a 2-year art school out of high school. So okay. I guess I would have graduated there. And graduated high school at 18, 19, 20, 21, something like that at the most. And I had gotten a job. I had shown some samples to Jim Shooter at a local comic shop because he's from the Pittsburgh area.
Oh, okay. And I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he looked at my samples at a shop appearance and a couple other guys too. And that conversation ended with him, you know, very... very hopeful for me because he walked out going, and I guess you and I will be talking. And I'm like, wow, okay, cool.
Oh, man, yeah.
but I didn't hear anything. And I tried, this was back in the day, this would have been 82, 83, you know, in the early 80s. So I would go to my art school that I went to, that I was a graduate of, and they had something that used to be called a Watts line, where you could make long distance phone calls with no charge.
Oh, okay.
And I would go down there and use that phone to call Marvel Comics. And of course, if you call Marvel Comics, say, I'd like to talk to Jim Shooter because he said I might have a job, they say, oh, I'm sorry, he's joined the French Foreign Legion. So that didn't work out. And so what ended up happening was I went on a few other job interviews, and I went on a job interview for a local animation house that did local and regional animation spots. And the guy was just looking for somebody who could draw. Who could storyboard for him and do character designs for him and could just draw without reference and all that. So he liked that in my portfolio, and he took me out to lunch and he said, now I know your plan, your goal is to work for Marvel Comics. I've wanted to do it since I was 8 years old. He said, but so I got a question for you. If I take the time to train you in animation and Marvel crooks its finger, do you just leave me in the lurch? And all this time I've invested in you was wasted. And I kind of sat there chewing, and he went, this is where you say no. I would never do that to you. You know, that,
yeah, yeah.
And I went, no, I would never do that to you. So what ended up happening was when Marvel did call, I took the job with the animation studio. He hired me, and I was working for him for a couple of years. When Marvel finally did call, my first contact was Al Milgrom. He handed the phone to Louise Jones, who is now Louise Simonson, and she offered me a fill-in on K-Sar. It was issue 17, actually. And, of course, I took it. And what ended up happening was, because of my promise to the guy that ran the animation studio, I stayed at the animation studio and did my freelance for Marvel at night. He was also very understanding. So if we didn't have something that was going out of the studio that day, if we weren't really busy at the studio, I was allowed to work on my Marvel stuff there as well. And I did both for, I guess, a couple of years.
Wow.
Because I did that through K-Sar, because I did the fill-in on K-Sar. They liked it enough that they offered me number 16 after I had just finished 17. So I did that. Then they gave me a King Conan, and then they offered me King Conan as a series.
Wow, nice.
And I turned it down because I didn't think I was ready to try to handle a regular monthly schedule. Then they offered me K-Sar as a series, and I was afraid they'd stop offering, so I took it.
And so I
did K-Sar. My run on K-Sar was done while I was still working at the animation studio. My run from there, I did like a couple of, while I was doing K-Sar, I did some Indiana Jones fill-ins, blah, blah, blah. I did Star Wars while I was still working at the animation studio. I did Marvel Team-Up while I was still working at the animation studio.
Ah, nice.
It was when I was offered The Amazing Spider-Man that I reached that crossroads where, you know, comics isn't going to get any more stable than being offered a monthly title like Spider-Man.
I wasn't ready,
but I also told myself that, you know, nobody else could be counted on to care as much as I did, so I'd give it 110%. So I took that, and it was at that point that I opted to leave the animation studio, and the rest, as they say, is history now. So does that give you a thumbnail anyway? So yeah,
'93
was when my first Marvel stuff came out. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And that's young?
Well, I mean, for me as a kid, you know, I'm not that much younger than you in the grand scheme of things, but I was probably about fourth, fifth grade, whenever you were in Spider-Man. So I guess to me, I just thought anyone who was working in comics had to be much, much older. So 24 didn't, you know, I had all of these strange illusions, and I've mythologized the Marvel bullpen since a young age.
Well, so. I can understand that to a certain degree. Yeah. I, you know, when you hear that Jim Shooter was writing the Legion at 13.
Well, yeah.
Right. The ancient, you know, that kind of thing. I know at the time what you're saying, I was kind of the opposite, because I had never heard of Tom DeFalco. I had seen his name on some DC Superman family stories, you know, some Jimmy Olsen shorts and all this kind of stuff. And I was aware of the name. But when he was named as the editor of the Spider-Man titles, I said, how does some kid who doesn't know anything get get awarded the Spider-Man titles? That's insane, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
As I was reading about it in the Bullpen Bulletins. And, you know, of course, once I got to know Tom and realized he's, you know, he's about 10 years older than I am. He's a much better shape, but he's 10 years older than I am. And, you know, so all of that perception that he was just some young punk kid, I was completely unaware of his entire career at Archie and, you know, his career at DC and the writing he had done for Marvel before he was given the Spider-Man titles, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it really, it's always amazing what somebody's window of references.
Sure.
The people that know me for the Marvel stuff know me for the Marvel stuff and sometimes don't know the other stuff I've done. And I've run into people at conventions who know me from Superman and don't know I'm a Marvel guy.
Really?
Uh-huh. I mean, yeah, I've talked to people at conventions who thought I came out of nowhere and got on Superman. You know, there you go. That's only, you know, it's what, 79% of my career that you're unaware of. So, okay. Like the Superman stuff? You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it can be bizarre that way, too. But, yeah, you only know what you know, and even with all the names on all the books, I mean, these days there's so many titles that it's hard to know everybody's name anymore.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah,
and it's hard to keep up with everything too. It's
I gave up.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It seems like you had quite a partnership with Tom DeFalco then. Did you first meet him on Amazing Spider-Man then?
Well, no, he hired me on Team Up.
On Team Up? Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was the editor of the Spider-Man titles at a time where he had Spider-Man guest starred. It kind of worked the way it's supposed to work, really. Spider-Man had guest starred in K-Star, and he saw that stuff and saw I could draw Peter Parker and saw I could draw a serviceable Spider-Man. So he offered me Marvel Team Up work. First was a fill-in, and then he hired me on as it doesn't really look like it because of how short a period of time it was and the way things were published, but I was the regular artist on Marvel Team Up for a brief, you know, New York minute. And so when he was my editor, he did a show here in town, and I remember sitting out to dinner with Tom and Jackson Geis, back when he was Butch Geis, working on Micronauts. And we all just kind of sat and BS'd and talked about comics and what kind of comics we like and, you know, how we felt about Marvel and Marvel characters and all this. And in that conversation, Tom and I came to realize that we, you know, liked the same kind of comics and were fans of the same types of work and all that. We didn't actually work together. It was Danny Fingeroth who put us together on Spider-Man.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, we were familiar with each other, being editor, freelancer, and such. In fact, at the time when I decided to leave the studio to do Amazing, Tom at that point had become kind of a mentor to me, I guess, in some ways, having been my editor on Team Up. And he actually called and said, you know, that it was time to be, he wanted to have a conversation with me, and he wanted to say that, you know, I do feel that you're going to have to pick one or the other. If you want to stay in animation, stay in animation. But if you want to do comics, and he was pretty open about the fact that he was kind of hoping I would pick comics, he said, but you might want to think about, you know, going to it full time. And I had pretty much already made the decision, but he certainly helped reinforce it. And I said, well, do you mind if I go comics full time on a book with you? Because they had offered us both Spider-Man, you know, and he went, oh, so you've already decided? I said, yeah, pretty much. And he goes, well, don't I feel like a jackass? No, not at all. It's a much needed affirmation that, you know, if you think I can do this, then that's really helpful to know that, you know, that I've got your support. And then we, you know, went together on Spider-Man and found out how much we enjoyed it. And mostly it's a terrific, it's become a terrific friendship. And professionally, I just respect the hell out of the work he does. Mm-hmm. He's a very good writer. He's a structure guy. He never just writes stream of consciousness. You know, he has a theme and a point to his stories, and he stays on point, and he always is telling you a story. And I respect the hell out of that. I enjoy reading his stuff, and I enjoy working on his stuff. And he's also just very, very open to collaboration, and has, you know, pretty much anything I know about storytelling and successful collaboration has come from my partnership with DeFalco. And I mean, to this day, there are a few. There's nobody I would rather work with than Tom, you know, that's not always the case. I mean, the gentleman I'm working with now on this new Sid Comics project is very creative, wildly creative, and he has a really kind of an interesting, fun voice. And he's really interested in doing, again, the same kind of thing Tom and I were. You know, this guy's very oriented. He grew up in the 70s and loved the Marvel comics of the 70s. And that's what he's looking for. And gotcha, that's very much my wheelhouse. And I can kind of unapologetically do the kind of comics that I love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
With motion lines and big impact marks and all that kind of stuff that nobody does anymore because it's too comic booky.
gotcha. Like, as far as the creative process goes, you know, working with Tom DeFalco and this new guy, is it how does it get to the page, I guess? Like, do you get the story first? Like, from Tom DeFalco, it sounds like you did. Like, he wrote the story.
You always get some kind of story first, whether it's full script or whether it's a plot synopsis, considered Marvel style. And I'm not sure how much that's done anymore, to tell you the God's honest truth. I think most of the industry has swung back towards full script, which it's kind of, I find it kind of a shame, because I thought Stan's innovation of doing a plot synopsis and relying on the illustrator more to tell the story visually was, you know, a simple kind of genius.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
When you're telling a story through art, it makes sense to have the artist telling the story.
Exactly. And there's just an amount of common sense logic there that can't be denied. In DeFalco's case, we would discuss plots. You know, if I had a suggestion, I made suggestions, and we might get around to them, we might not. You know, we both keep notebooks on story ideas and everything for Spider-Man and Spider-Girl and all the other stuff we worked on. And the story idea would always come from a discussion. On Spider-Man, it usually came from a discussion of the characters. It usually came from a discussion of Peter Parker and how he's feeling about what's going on in his life right now and everything. Whoever the idea came from, however it was hammered into shape, Tom would then go off and structure it as a plot synopsis. And, you know, so I'd be working off some kind of printed matter. We did an issue with Thunderstrike, which was probably more the way they did it back in the old days of Marvel, where I happened to be in New York for something else, and we sat in his office, and we plotted, I think it was issue 15 of Thunderstrike, in the same room together. And we kind of got it, you know, we worked out the story beats, and I made a couple of notes and went home and drew it, you know. You get the impression that that's more the way Stan used to do it with a lot of his guys, whether it was a phone conversation or whether it was an in-person meeting. And that was fun and a little scary, because you have less of a structure to work from and you're responsible for more. With this gentleman I'm working with right now, he, since he is... he's a TV writer, and he's you know, he knows very specifically what he wants, and he does have a certain visual sense given that he's from TV. So he is giving me much tighter plots. He's actually kind of giving me their synopsises, but they kind of break down to like a paragraph or a line for each panel, and I rarely go off book unless I really feel that there's a better way to handle it. I don't go off book, and I follow what he does. Then he looks at the thumbnails, and you know, he'll come back with some notes, and usually those notes are, you can cut that panel, you can cut this panel, I, you know, it turned out to be more than I needed, and all this. And I don't want to upset the boat on him, because when he goes into script, he needs to know what to expect. Because when we were originally doing the first issue, we did a much looser plot synopsis, and I sent him my first batch of thumbnails, and his brain short-circuited. He had no idea how to script it or how to approach it, because being from television, he was picturing it in his head. You know, it was, it's much easier until we get more in line with our own rhythms and everything, you know, and it takes time for a team to come together. I'm working on the third issue for him at the moment. I'm finishing up the second and working on the third. And, you know, I think we're coming more, like the second issue went much easier than the first issue, and the third issue would go that much easier than the second, as we get used to how we do things. But yeah, that first time when he saw my thumbnails, he just had no idea how to approach it. So we decided to go with something tighter. And you know, I'm a pretty easygoing guy. I mean, you tell me what you want, and I'll give it to you. My job is to draw what other people are telling me to draw. So I don't have a lot of ego involved in that, you know. In fact, this whole gig came about, this whole new gig came about because he wanted to hire Sal Buscema to draw the comic. Again, being from the 70s, being a 70s Marvel child, and Sal's not, Sal does not enjoy the blank page anymore.
Oh, no. If
you, you know, if anybody, if any of us have a finite number of pages in us that we're going to, you know, that you pencil them and you go, okay, I'm done. Who would have hit it besides Sal Buscema? Maybe, you know, Jack Kirby might have hit it, but, you know, Sal Buscema probably hit it. So he doesn't really enjoy that as much. And, you know, so he said, if you get Ron Frenz to pencil it, I'll be happy to ink it. But I'm, you know, I'm not interested in penciling it. This guy was fortunately aware of my Spider-Girl stuff and liked my Spider-Girl stuff. So that's how I got this gig, was through Sal. And Sal is inking it. And so we're having a lot of fun. And when the books finally break out and are released sometime next year, hopefully everybody will enjoy it. And I know I'm enjoying it. It's called Sit Comics. Because he came up through working on sitcoms.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was an assistant on Seinfeld, was one of his first jobs.
Oh, get out of here. Wow.
Yeah, he's worked on some stuff across the pond, and he's done TV shows over here in the States. And he's currently the executive producer and writer on Casey Undercover on the Disney Channel for Disney.
Oh, yeah.
My son watches.
With Zendaya, yeah. So, he's, you know, but he loves comics. He wants to do comics. He's got an entire line that he's got freelancers working on right now. Some of them are humor books. A handful of them are superhero titles. And his name is Darren Henry. And he's got a social media presence. Sit Comics, one word, is out there on Facebook. And some of the titles are available on Comixology and all that. But as far as the actual print rollout, we're looking at next year sometime, either spring or summer of next year.
Okay. Huh. Yeah, because you had some of those at the Pittsburgh show, I believe, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I was showing. He did a print run of the Blue Baron is the name of the character.
That's it. Yeah.
For Central PA, and we did a series of shop appearances because it's myself and Glenn Whitmore is the colorist on the titles who I worked with on the Superman books and oh my god. Because one of his other books is called Super Suckers. It's kind of an Archie style vampire story.
Oh, okay.
And it's being drawn by one of the guys that Jeff Schultz is drawing that for him, who's was working for Archie for years doing the Archie stuff. He's doing Super Suckers, and so the three or four of us did some shop appearances in Central PA, which is where Darren is originally from, and you know, we kind of introduced those books, test marketed those books, and we've been getting a lot of positive response. So I'm really looking forward to the rollout and seeing what the general audience thinks. And you know, I could be happy doing Blue Baron for years now if the marketplace decides that's what they want to see. So.
Nice. The like as far as the market kind of goes, like because you were kind of mentioning that you sent him clips and stuff like that. How is the that whole process, like the creative process, like you drawing? Has that changed? Is now that things are more digital? Do you still work on pencil and paper? And then
I do.
Do you? Okay.
Not everybody does, but yes, I still do. I mean, if you do the math, and I started in the early 80s in my 20s, I'm 56 now. Sal and I work well together because we still do things on paper. And I still send him the boards and the inks right on the boards. And, but so much of the stuff is being done digitally now. People are, you know, penciling digitally, but even if they pencil on boards, they're scanning and sending those to the inkers so they can output it in blue line or digitally ink it. So yes, the computers are taking over, but I really like working with the blank page, and you know, I do a set of smaller thumbnail drawings of each page, so I know where I'm going with it, and get the storytelling set up for the entire length of the book, so you don't run out of panels at the end or anything like that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, put it up on the boards and still doing it the old way. Sal has actually acknowledged technology when it comes to he will have his pages scanned and sent to a server for some of the major publishers now. He doesn't send off the actual boards as much as he used to. Most inkers don't anymore, actually. You know, even in, there's been a couple of inkers I've worked with, and they said, well, you can just scan them and send them. And I said, well, if it's all the same to you, I'd just as soon have you ink them.
Yeah.
Off the boards, but they will scan and send the inked version, and they'll just hold on to the pages and they'll do the divide and send me back my share of pages and things like that. So, but yeah, from what I understand, a lot of people are, you know, even the pencils, everything just exists in the digital world now, which is really gonna put a bite into the collector market. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, we discussed this before amongst ourselves. I'm a very tactile person, and I can appreciate the digital comics, but I like to have the actual comic in front of me. And I like the smell of comics and everything that reminds me of.
That's creepy, but I agree with you. There's nothing I enjoy more. In fact, I've been going through a phase lately where I there's a couple of comic shops that I go to, and they have long boxes with the comics of my youth, which I probably have copies of around my apartment somewhere, but going and looking for them would be a real chore. I'm you know, I go into these shops and I go through their $3 boxes, or there's one guy that anything under $50 he has in long boxes. So I can find stuff from the 60s from when I was a kid, from like 67 to 68, DC's and Marvel's. I can find them for like $6 or $7.
Yeah.
And I've been flipping through them and finding those and really enjoying rereading some of the books of my youth. I also get that by buying the DC showcases and the Marvel Essentials, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, I've been really, you know, I've been going all the way back to my first exposure to comics, which was like early Batman comics, Superman comics, and World's Finest, and just rereading some of those, just being charmed to death. I mean, those things were so clever, and I can still remember what it felt like to experience that stuff for the first time and go, God, someday I would love to be able to draw like this. You know, I mean, I can remember certain phases in my life. When the Aquaman cartoon came on in the late 60s, just was in love with it. I just loved everything about it. And I can remember very clearly sitting there and going, God, I hope someday I can draw as well as these guys draw. You know, that kind of thing. And I was very single-minded about it. I'll leave it up to you whether I never ever accomplished that.
Oh, without a doubt you did.
But I was very single-minded about it. Like I said, from the time I was 7 or 8, if you asked little Ron Frenz what he wanted to do, it was to grow up, work for Marvel Comics, and draw Spider-Man. And I was very directed and just very blessed to have accomplished that by the time I was like 25, 26. So I peaked early, and it's just been downhill ever since.
Just as a quick follow-up, who are your biggest influences, do you feel?
Who do you think were my biggest influences?
Well, I feel like Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby are two that stick out from your run on Thor and your run on Spider-Man. So,
who else? There's a couple more obvious ones. There's at least two more really obvious ones.
Two more really obvious ones.
Oh, come on. John and Sal Buscema.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. John Romita, you know.
Yeah,
Romita. Yeah, yeah.
Those guys just put it all together. I mean, Kirby, yeah. Eisner, Ditko. I mean, I really feel that in the last several years that a lot of what comics has become are poor man's movies. We've been trying too hard to be movies now. And I think we've kind of moved a little bit away from what comics does really well. And if you look at the Kirbys and the Eisners and what was perfected in my, this all my opinion, of course, but what was perfected at Marvel in the 60s and 70s was what comics do really well and uniquely, you know, because there are things that comics can do, the things that comics can get away with. Like if you think about the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby Fantastic Fours, if you read that dialogue out loud, it doesn't hold up. I mean, it's not. It would be very hard to even pull that off in a cartoon or in live action verbatim, there's something about comics that is translated through your eyeballs and your brain, but it's very melodramatic. It's very, you know, everybody's moving, everybody's in motion, especially in a Kirby comic. You know, things like that. That, you know, what's always fascinating to me with the characters being translated into film now is that if you take 5 fans and put them in a room and ask them to cast a Fantastic Four movie, every single person is going to have a different idea of who should be cast as even though it's a visual medium.
Yeah, yeah.
Put 5 people in a room and say, who should play Peter Parker? You're going to get 5 different answers.
That's very true.
That is very true, yeah.
Because that is part of the engagement in a comic book. Even though it's visual, you're not being spoon-fed. You know, your imagination is still a huge part of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. It is. I agree. I think it's totally it's a totally different type of media, like with the internal, even like the internal monologue you have of the characters and stuff like that. I don't think that can be done well, like on a show or even a movie.
Thought balloons. For decades, comics survived with thought balloons, and now it's the internal monologue has become captions. But come on, let's be honest. I mean, yeah, any kind of internal monologue like that is difficult to pull off. I mean, there have been a few movies that have been able to pull it off, but you know, that's unique to it. The way action is, you know, and again, I'm talking like comics of the 60s and 70s and 80s. The way action is portrayed, the way Jack Kirby would kind of use the human figure as a design element. You know, it was just, it's amazing. It's dynamic. It's something that can't be verbatim recreated live action. I mean, you can come close and you can create that kind of kineticism, and they do it very successfully, I think, in the Marvel movies. In X2, where the attack of Nightcrawler at the White House. Something that was just visceral and exciting and engrossing, and you couldn't do it the same way in a comic. You know, but it successfully translated to film that kind of kineticism and that kind of action and that kind of movement. So, I mean, it can be done and quite often is done successfully. But comics are comics, man. They're a very separate thing, and I don't think you're using the medium to its best extent if you're just doing storyboards for movies. If you're framing everything like a movie, or if you're having long talking head sequences like a movie, those are the things that kind of lose me, is when you just do a long talking sequence and yet the characters aren't doing anything. Because even in a film, you take Age of Ultron, Tony Stark and Steve Rogers are having their debate about what's going on with the Avengers. They're chopping wood while they're doing it. That wonderful moment when Steve shows that he's getting, that he's making his point in the conversation by tearing a stump in half. That's what we should be doing in comics. There should be something, since it's a visual medium, there should be something interesting going on visually while they're talking. I mean, back in the day, the X-Men used to discuss philosophy while they were working out the Danger Room.
Right.
Or Spider-Man would be having a debate with the Green Goblin while they're fighting over the city, but now we've lost that sense of wonder, and now, they just sit and talk. And it's like, that's great if it's a radio script, but come on, guys, it's a comic book.
How do you think can we get back to that that kind of writing in comics? What is it that young writers can start doing, or getting back to that way of storytelling?
You're out of my pay grade now, I'm afraid. Because the simple fact is, and this is something I've become very aware of over the last several years, is that we all love the comics that were of the first comics we read. Okay? I will always fault on the side of comics from the late 60s and 70s, because those are the first books I read that made me want to do what I'm doing. And I'm always going to value what they offered more than what's being done currently, or more than what was done before that. And in the same way, though, kids, and there's not a lot of kids still reading comics, but when somebody discovers the comics of the 2000s or the 2010s, that's what they love. And when they, quite honestly, when DeFalco and I got back together and we did that Thunderstrike miniseries back in, a few years back, there were a couple of reviews that were basically saying, who is this for? Because it looks like a 70s comic, but they're dealing with some more adult themes. Who is this for? I don't get it. And if it's not exactly what they expect a comic book to look like or a comic book to be, it doesn't do well. Unfortunately, the Thunderstrike miniseries kind of fell through the cracks because it wasn't part of the big story arc right then. It was, it's very difficult to break out in today's market. And it's really a part of this larger conversation people are having that involves politics and opinions and the way people interact now in social media and everything, is that everybody likes what they like and they stay in their lane. They're not really open to experimenting with other people, the way other people are trying to do things or being exposed. I mean, to me, even if you discover comics today, why aren't you curious about where they came from? Because you know, I did a lot of reading of comics from the 50s and the 30s and stuff. It's fascinating to me to read the original Batman stories.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah, absolutely.
To see the impetus
yeah.
of the character, or the original Superman stories, and to be aware of the history of the character. And early Marvel comics, you know, the Steve Ditko and the Jack Kirby monster and horror stories that they did. And you know, where these illustrators came from, you know, and how they've evolved and how they... But I'm also involved professionally, so I can see that that might not be where your love of the hobby might go, you know.
Yeah.
But I there really is this issue now where people aren't really reaching outside their own experience to try new things. And with the market being what it is, you know, everything's selling a little. It's just one of those situations where I don't know how you would do it. You know, I mean, I'm hoping that with Sit Comics, Darren Henry's voice is so fresh that, you know, it's kind of like the gentleman that did, and I'm not sure I can remember his name, but that did Heroes. Remember the first season of Heroes?
Yeah.
Because that guy didn't read comic books. He was doing a riff on superheroes. Yeah, because at one point he wanted to create a character who could control magnetism. And somebody said, well, there is a character like that. It's Magneto. He's in the movies. And he went, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know that. So they didn't do it, you know. So he was not a comic book reader as a kid or anything like that. Darren hasn't read comics since he was a kid. And he has these very wonderful and fresh ideas, and when we design characters, he sends me this disparate reference, you know, of could you try like a helmet like this, goggles like this, maybe some boots like this, and it's fun as all get out for me to take all this disparate stuff and try to bring it into a design. So he's got this, you know, very much 2016, 2017 take on these characters. They're very fresh takes on these characters, and he's not bogged down by knowing every character and going, well, I can't do that because that's sort of kind of like this, and I can't do that. And because of that, it's very fresh. I'm really enjoying, you know, his characters and his approach, and I'm hoping everybody else will too because of that different voice. Plus the fact this industry just loves somebody coming in from TV.
And
saying, I'm going to take a shot at comics, and everybody, you know, all you just have to say Seinfeld and people will at least try it.
I can see that.
So I'm kind of hoping that helps too.
And
that nobody's going, Ron Friends, isn't he dead? You know, and yes, I am. Buy the book because I'm penciling it from beyond the grave. That's cool.
That is cool. As far as like you know talking more about the industry, I guess today, it does seem like the comics are like almost more geared towards the movies instead of the other way around. Now it seems like now, like when somebody draws like Tony Stark, for example, they kind of looks like they try to draw him to look more like Robert Downey Jr.
Well, I are you seeing that as a negative?
I don't know. I just find that interesting.
Well, because I don't think it's wrong to do that. You know, I was one of the guys that when Disney bought Marvel, I smiled and I went, oh, cool, maybe we'll actually start, you know, maybe it'll actually help with marketing and all this kind of stuff, which it really hasn't yet. I kind of hope it still does.
Yeah.
But to make the books more relatable to, I mean, more people are going to see the movies than are ever going to pick up a comic book.
Yeah, that's probably
so
true.
So if
yeah.
people go to the movies and then they come into a comic shop and pick up the comic book, you want them to see something that is going to, you know, relate to the comic, you know, to the movie they just saw. You know, whether it's, you know, you influence the design of the character that way, or so I wish they were seeing more content that reflected the movies, to tell you the truth. And by that, I just mean that all the characters aren't irredeemable pricks, because it's just stunning to me now that they're writing for adults how all the characters have feet of clay. It's just It's amazing to me. But, you know, when you think about it, when you if you would have gone to the first Spider-Man movie and really enjoyed the first Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
Your best bet going into a comic shop would have been to pick up a Marvel Essentials.
Yeah.
The 60s John Romita Stanley John Romita run would have been your best bet to see something that looked like that movie.
Right.
Yeah.
You know. So I can't say I blame them for trying to be available in that way, that if somebody comes in from seeing the movie and wants to read Guardians of the Galaxy, that it's going to at least somehow relate to the movie they just saw, you know?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Because, of course, when they said Guardians of the Galaxy, I'm an old man, I'm thinking, really? Martin X and Charlie 27?
When they first announced it, that's what I thought, too.
Well, it's the same way when they announced the Losers, though. I didn't know about the second generation of Losers. I'm thinking, oh, the World War II stuff? Great. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm a little behind the curve on that kind of thing. So to have me talk about the current industry, it would be a little unfair because I'm not completely aware of what's going on these days. You know, at the time in the 80s, with DeFalco being highly placed in the company and me being a little more involved in monthly books, I mean, things have changed. But it was always frustrating even then because, you know, comic retailers, God love them, they are just trying to keep their doors open, man. You know,
during
the 90s when we had kind of a boom, they were just happy if the books moved out. You know, I mean, we were losing sales. Thunderstrike sold really, really well. Thunderstrike wasn't canceled because of low sales. It was canceled because of that whole Perlman thing. But what was happening during the run of Thunderstrike is that they'd get the books in on Wednesday, they'd sell through by Friday, and they wouldn't reorder.
Oh.
Because they were just happy that they sold through.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was killing us. I mean, you know, you can't increase sales if they're not the next week ordering one more copy or two more copies, you know, and seeing how that goes. But there's so much product that it's very hard for them to stay ahead of the game on that kind of thing, you know? And to this day, it's why Marvel doesn't have more of an interface with the retailers. You know, first you decide, okay, the only way people are going to be able to get our books is to go through these independent retailers scattered all over the country. And then second, we're not going to interface with them at all. We're not going to give a shit what they think. We're not going to send out surveys. We're not going to ask them what we're doing right and doing wrong. You know, we're just going to let it run the way it runs. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I kind of...
And I've heard that complaint from easily a half dozen comics retailers over my time in the industry.
Yeah, I kind of miss, like, back in the 80s and the 90s comics, at the back of the comics, it would have, like, fans, like, interacting with, like, the writers, like, hey, I like issue blah, 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 like, 19 or something like that. Now, it's just straight comic, and there's no, like you said, there's no really interaction with the fans, and maybe that's with the different social medias or whatever, but...
Yeah, that's what they're trying to... They're supposedly that shifted over to social media and, you know... Dan Slott has had varying success with Twitter, you know, things like that. I mean, I think that immediacy has kind of, I'm not talking about Dan specifically because I really don't follow Dan on Twitter or anybody on Twitter, but the immediacy of artists posting things on their blogs or on their Facebook pages and things being spoiled as quickly as they are, I don't think that's a good thing for any kind of serialized.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's good for TV. I don't think it's good for, you know, there's nothing good about a big twist in a TV show being spoiled because somebody got a picture of that actor on set.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be dead or something. You know what I mean?
It takes away a little bit of the magic of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I was reading comics, I was waiting every month for the next issue to come out, and I was, you know, thank God.
Yeah.
I didn't have somebody showing up at my house going, oh, and by the way,
yeah.
John Romita's only going to be doing two more issues, and then he's going to go over and do this, and it's like, shut up. Just let me enjoy what's going on in the book.
Exactly, yeah. I remember reading comics and just, you know, making sure that I, when I opened it up, I was at the very first page so I didn't ruin anything for myself. Exactly. That might have been, you know.
Yeah, I being more into the art, I would occasionally ruin something for myself because I would flip through. I mean, I always liked comics back when I was a kid, and we did it one time, at least once on Thor. I mean, we might have done it more than once, but we say, don't flip to the end or you'll ruin the greatest shock ending you've ever
seen. Yeah, I remember.
That's we did it on Thor when we did the Don Blake as Mephisto reveal, you know, and it's like, try not to ruin this for yourself. Don't just flip casually. Start at page one, sit down, you know, the DeFalco will even do that in the opening caption sometimes. You know, sit down, crack a soda, get your favorite snack, and let's have some fun for 10, 15 minutes, you know, that kind of thing. So, of course, I don't think most comics read 10, 15 minutes anymore either, so, you know.
That's probably true,
Yeah, that's true. Used to get a lot more story.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, this stuff I'm reading from the late 60s. Everything back then, entertainment was so much more dense. I mean, at some point, turn on TV Land or turn on MeTV and watch an old Bonanza. These stories never go where you think they're going to go. I mean, you know, they do the setup in the first 10 minutes, and on today's dramas, that's it. You know, whatever's going on in the first 10 minutes, you're going to resolve that situation by the end of the hour, okay? But in Bonanza, in these old Bonanzas, you start in one situation in the first 10, 15 minutes, then you follow a secondary character, then it becomes a different story, and it's a completely different story by the time you get to the end of the hour. And that is just fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Because you were engaged as a viewer. You weren't just waiting for the end. You were engaged when, wow, I didn't see that coming. Okay. Oh, you know, so it was, they were dramas, but they were almost written like mysteries where there were different reveals and different left turns, and it kept the viewer engaged. And they felt like, well, we're going to be, if we expect them to sit there for an entire hour, we need to engage them. You know, that kind of.
Yeah.
You know, God forbid you do that. And that's the other thing I enjoy about working with DeFalco is that you get a story. You get a beginning, a middle, and an end with a writer like Tom. And one of my things that I was really gratified to see is when they started collecting the Amazing Spider-Girl run as trade paperbacks, the first trade paperback worked so well because we did everybody was doing the 6-issue arcs, but what we did was we did 6 issues that each worked as an individual, 6 individual stories, but if you read it as a trade paperback, there are things that are resolved in the arc.
Nice.
Not only do you get to the end of the 6th issue and you have an ending, but you get to the end of each individual issue and have an ending, but you get to the end of the trade paperback and it's kind of like watching a movie with 6 acts, you know, that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
And I was really proud of our run on Amazing Spider-Girl, also the entire run of Spider-Girl, what we were able to accomplish, and we had great loyal fans. I mean, it was just it was a terrific experience interacting with the fans online and then on the Spider-Girl message board and at conventions. And they're just some terrific people who enjoyed that book for appreciated it for what it was. And which, you know, that right there is proof that any kind of comic can survive if you can, you know, keep your audience engaged, you know. Spider-Girl was kind of off in its own little corner and it was never part of the big crossovers, but we had an audience that kept us alive for what, 13-14 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was the longest running solo title headlined by a girl, you know. So I mean, we were doing something right.
Definitely. That's awesome. And speaking of the, like, big story arcs and crossovers and stuff, was that ever because, you know, it seemed like they'd always try to do like an annual type of event that involved several different comic books. How do you feel about those types of things? It seems like sometimes they would like force that into a comic book.
They do them too much now. Yeah. They do them so much now that I don't think they're as special as they should be. And what shocks me is that they will get an uptick when a character is killed. And it's like, guys, stop supporting that.
Yeah.
Right. Right. They're going to stay dead.
Yeah.
And even if that writer, you know, is absolutely positively sure that that character is dead, he's not going to be on the book forever. And the next guy that comes in is going to say, oh, no, he's not. He's alive.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So it's just gotten to the point of ridiculousness where the fans don't even yawn anymore.
Yeah,
when somebody dies, and that's depressing. I mean, so could we stop doing that? Just put a moratorium on that, just because it's not interesting anymore.
Yeah, I'd rather have a fresh story take or something like just you know,
absolutely.
Yeah,
character development rather than destruction.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, Captain America: Civil War got criticized because nobody died.
Yeah, and I actually think that's probably what made that movie the best.
That's one of the things I enjoyed about it, because it made me more concerned that Rhodey recovers. You know that.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And the drama there. I mean, I own it on, you know, of course everybody does, I guess, but I went out and bought it on Blu-ray, and when I watch it now, I don't find myself going to the airport fight as much as I thought I would. I love the dynamics between Steve and Tony in that film.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite scenes is when Steve's ready to sign. You know, he gives him the pen
and
all kind of stuff, and he's ready to sign until he finds out that Wanda's under lock and key, and it's, God damn it, Tony.
Yeah.
Where we started, you know, that kind of thing. And it's just, what a terrific movie. It just really was engaging as hell.
It is. It's probably my favorite Marvel movie.
I can understand that. Yeah. I mean, certainly as a Marvel fan, you're sitting there during the airport fight just...
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
getting to see Spider-Man interact with those characters made me so happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right there with you. I'm really looking forward to Homecoming.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. We saw a little trailer
teaser trailer came out today.
I saw that teaser. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it tonight on Kimmel that you're supposed to run the trailer or something?
I don't know. I didn't hear when the actual trailer was. I just watched the 17 second teaser and was giddy.
See, I found it online.
On Kimmel, I think. Maybe tonight.
Oh, that's fantastic.
They're going to run it like they did the Doctor Strange trailer.
So. Oh, yeah.
Check that out.
He's ABC, which is Disney. So
Get the tie-ins.
Yeah.
Of course, that's still Sony, but now Sony's riding on their coattails. So.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness they are, though.
Yeah.
I'm all for it. Anyway, next question.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your Thor run. You had quite a long run on Thor, like what?
7 years.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Because we were talking, and I'm like, man, I don't think I've held a job for 7 years.
and believe me, that was one of the things that was so wonderful about it. I have never been the greatest thing to looking back on it is that I don't regret that I didn't appreciate it at the time, because I appreciated it every day.
That's awesome.
It was just a wonderfully creative time with DeFalco. It's, the character is endless. You know, he came up with the twist of Eric becoming Thor and re-energized us for another few years. And of course, Thunderstrike came out of that. Ralph Macchio is a terrifically creative editor who, you know, lets you do your thing. And so the whole 7 years was just an incredible fun time. I mean, the other time that came really close to that was working on, anytime I'm working with DeFalco, it's like that, but working on A-Next was just so much fun, because, you know, he was editing the other titles, and so I had that much more story input, and, you know, the stories were kind of reflecting some of my sensibility, maybe even a little bit more than some of our other stuff, and it was just such a joy to take those characters and you know, keep coming up with some thoughts and ideas, figuring out where they go from here, and yeah, but I mean, I I was a Thor fan because I was a Kirby fan because I was a John Buscema fan, you know, so I always followed Thor, but I never really saw myself as doing Thor. DeFalco didn't think he could do Thor because he saw himself as being much more qualified to do like the street level characters, like your Spider-Mans and your Ben Grimms and things like that. But, you know, he ended up really enjoying it as well. And, you know, that after coming in after Walt, we knew we couldn't do Walt, so we just kind of went back to the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby sandbox. And what a fantastic place to play. I mean, the Marvel Universe is just, you know, in the 80s, like that, it was a much... It sounds funny saying it now because it was so much bigger than it was in the 60s, but it was a leaner sandbox back then. You had guys like Mark Gruenwald who were keeping track of things, and, you know, we were doing the Handbook of the Marvel Universe. And,
oh, I love, those. Yeah.
I love those.
There were the occasional little crossovers that had nothing, like the when in Walt... Thor when he opened the Cask of Ancient Winters, and at the end of a bunch of other Marvel books it snowed at the end, you know, and it just snowed in the other books in the middle of the summer, and you either explained it or you didn't. I mean, in Spider-Man we used it as a punchline for a joke, you know.
Nice.
Bagman and stuff. That kind of communication between the editors and between the creative people was there for fun. You know, it wasn't there so we could do yet another big epic crossover where people die and everybody's depressed, you know, that kind of thing. The stuff that really gets me is, you know, like Submariner having his head torn off, or Submariner killed Black Panther, or Black Panther killed Submariner, or something like this. The whole Illuminati idea.
Oh, it's
away from the beginning, you know, that kind of thing. And I understand. I'm from a different era, and this stuff isn't being written for me, and I get that. So I don't mouth off about it that often, other than to say it's not really my taste, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. Yeah.
I think sometimes they're going.
You are welcome to mouth off because you have a podcast.
I think everyone's trying to do the whole Dark Knight.
Try making it darker.
Darker.
See, that's what I was afraid of when they did Watchmen The Dark Knight. I was like, please don't let superhero movies go this way, because then I won't be able to enjoy the movies either.
Yeah.
I'm glad to see they didn't.
Yeah. The only thing, like with the Batman versus Superman stuff, it just seems like when DC does their films, they seem to try to make them too dark as well.
I think they're seeing that the comics audience is mostly adults, and so they're not. I mean, I don't have a problem with adults reading comics. I mean, I read comics up through the 80s and 90s and stuff. So I don't have any problem with comics being readable by adults. But the fact that we are now producing product as an industry that kids can't go anywhere near
doesn't
make any sense to me, because the whole industry is built on wish fulfillment. It's built on the childhood fantasy of power and trying to, you know, be able to help people and all this kind of jazz. And so the idea that kids aren't welcome amazes me and dismays me. You know, Stan cracked the nut. You know, he was able to write things that functioned on those two different levels. You know, the same way when I was growing up, you could watch Star Trek and enjoy it as a colorful action story, and then you know, 15 years later, you go back and rewatch those episodes, and you're going, "Holy shit, they're talking about Vietnam!"
Yeah.
That's Stan cracked that nut for comics, and it was, you know, it worked. So I don't understand why we're not challenging ourselves to still do that kind of material, where these characters function for the kids, function for younger kids and 11 and 12 year olds and teens. crazy, and that we, you know, we're hurting ourselves with by not broad. I mean, we also, in a way, we also kind of hurt ourselves by going into the retail stores exclusively, because I'm not sure I would have discovered comics as a kid if I would have had to go to one of the comic book stores around here to find them. I mean, when I was growing up, they were everywhere.
Yeah, I used to get them every week at the grocery store.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
On my way home from school.
One of my earliest interactions with comic books was the food store that my folks used to go to shop every week. We were allowed to sit at the comic book rack and flip through comic books, and when they were done shopping and they came back to get us, my brother and I could pick one, you know.
Yeah.
And then when we became avid comic readers, we didn't really have an allowance, but my dad would spring for comics every week. You know, we'd go to three different places. We'd go to a National Record Mart, a magazine stand, and a Sun Drug with a spinner rack, and we'd get our comics every week, and he was willing to pay for them if we did our chores and all that kind of stuff. Of course, back then, comics weren't more than a quarter either. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's true.
But it really is, you know, we've kind of painted ourselves into this corner now where, you know, kids can discover the characters through children's books and all this, but, you know, whether or not that evolves into a love of the form, what are these kids going to read when they're, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14? I mean, that used to be prime comic book reading time.
That was definitely my age.
So now there's Disney books for real young kids, and then there's stuff that's dealing with subject matter that isn't appropriate yet, so we're losing them. We're losing them to any number of different distractions, you know, that they can spend their money on in the meantime.
Right. I have a nephew that is around, like, about 6 or 7, and my brother knows nothing about comic books, so they come talk to me about it. And, yeah, it is, like, hard to kind of steer them which comics to read because, like you said, there are the Disney XD, Spider-Man, and Avengers, and then there's the comics that are, like, the regular universe, and it's kind of like it's a little too adult for him to read right now. And like you said, it's you're going to get lost when we're old enough to not read the Disney XDs, but not too young to read regular comics. So,
and that age group is when I was into it the most.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I would agree. I would agree totally.
You know, I just read when I was doing my little thing through the long boxes, I bought new copies of the last, it was a 3 or 4 part story. It was Roy Thomas's last arc on the Avengers before he left, with Rich Buckler and Joe Sinnott, where they fought the Sentinels. And that was like 1972, I think, or something. And so I would have been like 12 years old. And I sat and read that whole arc again. And my God, was that fun.
Oh, yeah.
Roy was at the top of his game. And Sinnott was at the top of his game. Buckler did a beautiful job on it. And, you know, it had, you know, all those stories, they were very dense. And they were quoting, you know, things that adults would recognize. It's very much that whole Star Trek thing. You know, you go back and read it, and now, when I was 12, I had no idea what Lafayette, We Are Here was a reference to. You know, Roy would make, you know, and Stan would make those literary references all the time, but the story didn't hinge on them. You know, the kid could, as a kid, you could still read them and enjoy the hell out of the story and go, you know, maybe you looked it up and found out something you didn't know before. I remember there was an issue with Thor called Conflagration. And I had no idea what conflagration meant in when I was 11 or 12, but I looked it up and there you go.
Yeah.
Wow, comics as a possibly educational tool. You know, where might that go?
Right. I was trying to take that class in college.
That would be terrific. I mean, you know, they used to be a lot more like, but we've lost that age group now. So, you know, we're not. It's just my in my humble opinion type stuff. I mean, but yeah, if we're talking about my vibe, you know, I really am. That's the other thing that this guy's doing with Sid Comics is he's trying to do all age comics that, you know, have a nice modern voice, and he's, you know, he's going to be rolling out humor books first because that's what he's known for in his in his CV. So, you know, he's going to roll out Sid Comics with some humor books because there's not that many humor books in the market these days, and then like the second wave he'll introduce some of the superhero titles and stuff. So it makes a lot of sense. You know, he seems to be really level-headed and logical about how he's approaching it. And you know, I can only hope it's a big success because you know, I will benefit from it, but I also am just a big fan of what he's doing. So
we look forward to seeing that for sure.
Yeah, definitely, absolutely.
Well, like I said, you can go on Comixology and you can you can read some of them online already. But yeah, the book. I mean, they're actually what he's planning on doing is bi-monthly 64-page comic books.
Oh wow!
Online, they're being released three chapters, you know, as three chapters. But when they're released in print, they're going to be called what he's calling binge books, where you get a 64-page story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. So, you know, it's for $5.99.
Oh wow!
So yeah, that's a good deal. The business model at this point, and if it clicks, it could be a lot of fun. So.
Yeah.
This is Rick back again. This concludes part one of our two-part podcast with Ron Friends. Make sure you come back and check out part two. And also check us out on allofmyissues.com, at allofmyissues on Twitter, and find us on Instagram and Tumblr as well. And you can always email us at allofmyissues@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.